Hello and welcome to edition 378 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On today's programme, we'll be joined by Breton musician Jan Tiersen, the mind behind the sounds that brought cinematic classic Emily to life. Will be telling us why his home turf, the tiny island of Aerschen, is the inspiration behind his latest album, Usa.
Later on, we'll also be welcoming back Henry Hitchings to the Weekly. The literary and theatre critic will be telling us why his new book, celebrating the places we buy books, browse the world in bookshops, is a page-turner in itself.
And we'll be talking food with Jodie Caller, the chef who's looking to put the culinary culture of Palestine on a plate.
Plus, Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be plating up the potential highlights to be found on next week's front pages in the news look ahead. And we'll play some Jan Tiersen tunes, of course, too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Andrew, another week bites the dust. It's always a busy one when production week rolls around.
Strange phrase. Quite hard to bite dust, don't you think?
I'd give it a go.
Yeah.
I prefer a delicious plate of Palestinian treats. And we've got that coming up.
Or a German sausage. I know you and a...
That requires context, surely.
Well, it does. Because we had the last Friday of every month, we have a food truck come in. And this week it was Hermann's the German.
I mean, I've got to say one of my favourites, Andrew. And did you notice, despite a call for seconds, I only ate one wurst?
That's because you haven't been very well.
But I have withered away slightly.
Josh Fennett was down there for that second. Like, you know, God, he was barging people out of the way.
His chair was still spinning as it dropped into the inbox, that email saying. Yeah.
I've seen more amiable rhinoceroses herding across a field. He was down there. He got in there.
He's going to love that. What else has been going on, Andrew? I mean, it's been a
new
busy...
book out, new food book, talking food.
It's a bit of a food and drink theme.
The Monocle guide to drinking and dining. Let's see how we put drinking first.
Is it important. Selling like hot cakes?
Well, it is. It's doing super, super well. So that's been good fun. We launched that this week here in London, and there's going to be some nice events around the world in the run up to Christmas. We had some other entertaining things going on here for some friends of the brand. It's been a really crazily busy week.
But calm has settled. It's Sunday lunchtime. There's a gentler, more kind of easygoing aspect about the day, isn't there?
Well, let's destroy that now.
It's Henry Rhys Sheridan. Henry, oh Henry, blow the way you jump and rock. All right. Henry, oh Henry, blow the way Texas hop. But how am I doing now? Everything is all right.
Henry, welcome to the show. Now, we've got to point out there are two Henrys on the show today.
It's competitive.
How do we distinguish the two of them?
Good Henry and Rubbish Henry?
Yeah, Rubbish Henry, welcome to the show. Oh, sorry, we didn't mean that. We mean young, youthful, beautiful Henry.
That's nice.
No, the other one. The other one. And you.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me. And Tom.
Good.
Good to be here.
Where should we start?
We're going to begin on the 4th of October with the Vice presidential debate taking place in Virginia ahead of the US election. Are either of you even remotely interested in the vice presidential candidates this year?
I thought you meant the magazine Vice. Okay, I understand now. I'm kind of interested.
Tim Kaine, Mike Pence, in comparison to their superiors, they're not exactly big characters, are they? Do you remember the days of Biden v. Palin, 2008?
Not really either. Interestingly, the vice presidential debate has never really garnered the headline, with that one exception. I can't remember when it was. Was it sort of in the 80s and somebody slated someone in one of them?
Okay, that's really kind of stuck in people's memories then. That's
cultural
really...
history.
No,
with
what was his name?
Tom Edwards. Was it Quayle?
So the one that people always point out is back in the 80s.
Was it?
Dan Quayle,
yeah.
Who was basically seen off by his elder and better. But then evidence of the fact that it doesn't really make an enduring impression is the fact that I can't remember who saw him off.
And I always get confused between Dan Quayle and Dennis Quaid. The two of them are...
Those are two very different people.
Okay, good.
Not to be confused. But no, I mean, one thing that I'm interested in is obviously a lot of attention has been focused, and I think an increasing amount, it seems, on the anchors in these debates. Mm. And part of the reason for that is because they're such tightly controlled events on the part of the candidates' teams that actually one of the few kind of elements that can inject excitement into it is the questions of the anchor. And anchoring this one will be Elaine Quijano. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. But it's interesting. I wonder if they are in a similar position to their superiors who anchor the presidential debate as the vice presidential candidates are relative to the presidential candidates. Do you see what I mean?
Could be, Henry.
Shall we move on?
Yes.
You don't want to comment on that. Nobel Peace Prize winner announced in Norway, 7th of October 2016. We don't know who it's going to be. Because
but you can have a wild stab in the dark, surely.
Well, there's been a record number of nominations this year. 376 people and organisations have been put forward as potential Nobel Peace Prize winners. But, of course, we don't know who they are until 50 years has passed. They don't release the
who's nominated.
List. Yeah, exactly. We just know the winner. It'll be interesting
and
to see
who... And how close to the vote or the reveal does this happen? Because, obviously, we've seen some pretty high-profile peace processes which are kind of ongoing right now. We look, for example, to Colombia. Can that still be in the mix?
I don't know, actually. That's an interesting question. I don't know when the deadline was. Because sometimes, might be thinking like, so with some music awards, you'll have albums which were released 2 or 3 weeks beforehand not eligible, but then they win it the year after.
Well, it's the same as the Oscars. Like the same as the Oscars. There's the window of opportunity you have to get your film out in a set time. I think that the Santos and the FARC leader, Timoshenko, I think they would be oddly good nominees. Because it's quite good to see people cross the line from being rebel, insurgent fighter to a Democrat. I would be happy for both of them to get up.
I think so. And if you're looking for a real peace process that it marks a genuine sea change, that's as arresting as anything that I can think of in the last few years, in fact.
Yeah. Well, I think also it's a question of weighing, I'm not sure what the criteria for selection are, but it's a question of weighing up kind of sexiness versus efficacy sometimes, I think.
Sexy peacemakers.
In the sense that, you know,
it's
obviously...
It's a new section in the magazine.
Well, I think, you remember there was a big furore when Obama got it, I think in 2008.
Well,
but that was because he was sexy, wasn't it? No other reason. He hadn't done anything.
He didn't even do any real peacemaking.
Well, not really.
Maybe Justin Trudeau will get it this year then.
Maybe, if that is the criterion. We'll wait and see. I'm sure he's been nominated. I'm sure he's among the 376 people in the organisation.
Absolutely bound to be.
I'd be surprised if I'm not. and finally, US minimalist composer Steve Reich is going to be celebrating his 80th birthday on the 3rd of October. Are you familiar with his work, either of you?
Yeah, Counterpoint.
Yeah? You're a fan?
Mm-hmm.
So he obviously has been rivals... Sorry, go on, Andrew.
No, I was just wondering if he's going to, like, bang out happy birthday for himself on the old Joanna, or is just going to be like, bing.
I'm not sure.
That'd be very new take.
I would like to see a Steve Reich arrangement of happy birthday. Interesting little factoid. When he was a fledgling composer in New York in the I think late 50s and early 60s, he and Philip Glass, his kind of biggest rival and collaborator, actually made money by running a removals company together.
That's not true, is it?
That's completely true. Look it up. Nice little bit of trivia of a Sunday afternoon. Why not? So you look impressed by that, and Andrew just looks...
No, I'm just hoping it's true.
Bemused.
It's not one of those like stories... Because you did sell me a pup the other week. Was on some old rubbish story that turned out to be utter nonsense when I quizzed someone.
We should just asterisk the news look ahead.
No, I'm sure it's true.
None of these things are maybe actually
true. You should
true.
Probably assume.
Here, Phil, give that piano a bit of a shove. I can't get it up the stairs, mate. Was it a bit like that, do you think?
I think that was exactly what it was like.
I would like to know some potential names of the Reich Glass Removals Company.
I could actually look up the name of the company itself.
Kick some glass.
No, you want some puns, don't you? That's where you're going.
Glass Ruffle? I don't know.
Well,
there must
the
be
glass
so
ones are easy. Glass Act.
Yeah. Yeah.
Reich on time.
There we go. Mm. Look at that. You're very good at those, aren't you?
I don't know.
Yeah, good. Okay. I think is that all you've got for us, Henry?
Yeah. Well, don't say it like that.
No, it was good. It was good.
The Philip Glass runneth over. Let's wrap things up.
Okay, Henry, thank you so much for coming to see us. Jan Tiersen is the Breton musician, perhaps best known for his evocative pieces added so much to the playful cinema masterpiece Amelie. His latest project is his first solo piano record, Ussa, with all the songs inspired by his home, the tiny island of Ushant in the English Channel, or rather on the edge of the Celtic Sea.
But the original incarnation of the album wasn't a traditional record at all. Last year, Jan released it as sheet music, along with field recordings of sounds found on the island. Via a website, Jan used photos of the island to inspire those reading the music, who were encouraged to play their own interpretations, combining their unique performances with those found sounds from his home island. But don't worry if you don't read music, or if you simply would prefer to hear Jan's iteration, fear not. After a sold-out tour, including several sold-out nights here in London at the Barbican, Jan recorded his own interpretation of the music at London's Abbey Road Studios, and the album is out this week. We'll be speaking to Jan in just a moment, but first let's hear Cadoran from the new album. That is Cadoran from the album Ussa, and Jan Tiersen, I'm delighted to say, joins us here in Studio One. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Jan. Tell us about this record, because it's an amazing thing, and you can kind of watch it, you can listen to it, you can hear the found sounds. If you're a gifted and able musician, you can play it yourself along with the found sounds. It works on so many levels. Was that always how you saw this thing emerging, or did you keep adding layers as you went?
Actually, it was a really simple project. It was like to do a sort of musical map of the island where I live, and to put focus on some places, and to record field recordings, and to juxtapose field recordings with music and with piano pieces, and to release it as a sheet music, as a book, because I thought it's good to give the people the opportunity to play it. It wasn't even like I wanted to record the album, but after a while I just like did some shows, and then it becomes a completely different thing, because I rework on the field recordings and create some drones with it to fit the music, and it was a big part of improvisation as well in between the tracks, so it was obvious that it wasn't going to be an album.
And tell us a little bit about the island that's been the inspiration for this piece. I've never heard of the island before we had met you today, and before I went online to look a little bit about it. Tell us about...
It's on the weather forecast.
Good. So tell us about your home and why it is so inspirational.
It's a piece of land of 8 kilometers by 4. It's quite rocky, no trees, except in my garden. I'm quite lucky. 800 people live there full time.
But why did you decide to root the music here? You travel widely, you have an option of writing about anything. What made you feel drawn to the very soil beneath your feet to inspire you?
First of all, I did my third album there. Actually, I can count the album that I didn't record on the island. I just did 3 outside the island. So it's always been present and more linked to my music. On top of that, I think nowadays, it's really important and to find again the link with the earth, to be aware of the ecosystem we're living, that, I mean, locally. And it's the only thing now I believe it being essential to share with people.
But isn't it that sense of being part of the Celtic world, being in Brittany, is that really a big part of your personal identity?
Yeah, nature as well. And, focus on the local stuff, on growing things. And I think it's a political act as well. It's the only response we can give to consumerism and to globalization, because obviously it's hard to find political solutions. So, like, everybody can start small revolution in his corner.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it was funny how you were talking about the record and about the sheet music is out there and people can kind of take it and interpret it how they like. What's your relationship with your own work? Do you feel like it's something that you're giving to the world? Is there almost a philanthropic gesture there? Or does it change once you then record the album? Do you feel a different sense of ownership around it? How do you view your music? Do you like the idea that you're giving something? Because a lot of the fans of your work they're incredibly sort of devoted, and I wonder whether that's because there's a reciprocity in that relationship. They feel like there's something very genuine that they can get from you from listening to your music.
It's just like music is my activity. It's what I'm doing, like, most of the time. And then I just release record to share that with people. It's not giving my, you know, music to the world, but just sharing. And I think it's like, what can I share? And what am I? The place where I live is inside me. And in everybody, like, I think it's really important that the place you're born or the place you just, like, let your luggage and when you just find your place in the world,
where your roots are, perhaps. And tell me a little bit more then about the response to the record from people from the island. You mentioned, what, just sort of 800 or so. It's a pretty small population. Do people find that they can hear authentic sounds of the island that they recognise as well? What do your sort of neighbours and friends back home, what do they say about the music?
I'm
sure they're very complimentary, no?
Yeah, but I don't know. We're really close. So it's actually, we don't talk about it that much. Like, for instance, like I will be on tour and I was thinking, fuck, shit. Like, the first place I have to play is Ocean and I have to do it. And unfortunately, I will do it after the tour, which I think it's not really cool and not really fair. But yeah, we're really close. Like, because
that'll be special to play the music at the scene. Will it be actually one of the places that inspired the different tracks?
No, I already did that for the album before Infinity, which was really linked as well to the island. And then we just, like, for the release day, we just did a big gig in northwest of the island.
And yeah, Tommy, we referenced at the beginning there that, you know, you'd had many, many successful albums, and then you found, I presume, a more instant global fame with the work you did for Amelie. How difficult is that when you are writing to a film, you're writing to commission, and when you're allowed the freedom to sit down and make your own album? Do you find it an easy process being individual and then being part of a team?
To be honest, I never wrote for movies. Just Amelie was like, just except for my first, second, third and fourth album and some unreleased track. Because I find it really difficult to... For me, music is more something abstract and beyond the language. It's not the language. It's like, you know, you can express feeling, emotion. But it's really hard to try to compose music on images. On top of that, when you work with people in movie world, like, they just ask, like, can your music be a bit more orange? And then you spend like half an hour talking about the orangeness of what you did. And so I find it really hard. So, to be honest, I kind of shooting and I just give tracks. And the only thing I do when I work for movies is just, like, cut the track to the good length.
So that's much more of a kind of a functional thing, really, for you.
Yeah, but I just did one original score for a fiction movie. It was Goodbye Lenin, and that's it.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm quite old now, so it's like maybe in 20 years.
That's a pretty reasonable ratio. Yeah. And tell us about what happens with this record. Do you find that people, you know, you invite people to give their own interpretations? I imagine that you're maybe one of those composers, musicians, that people are always keen to share their take, their iterations. Do people send you a lot of stuff saying, oh yeah, and please will you listen to my version? Does that happen? Do you like to hear that?
Yeah, I was really curious when I released the book, you know. So I went on YouTube and watched the people playing the tracks.
Are they pretty good?
Yeah, but actually, I was as well, oh fuck, yeah, but I want to play it differently.
And tell me, the work that you're continuing to do, when you listen to it, many people think you've had a classical training, but your biography is quite clear that you had a small amount of training, but much of this is a self-taught world of music. How did that journey into music begin?
I was quite lazy when I was young, so I just quit the music school quite early. And after, it was late 80s, early 90s. And so I was in bands. And I was really fan of electronic music as well. So I just, industrial music. Like, I think the starting point of me doing the music that I just developed was working with the first samplers and sampling a lot of different stuff and thinking of instruments as noises or a way to make noises or to make sounds. And then after a while, I was like, you know, spending my days with a CD player and vinyl and to record, like, you know, orchestras except or stuff like that. And it was a bit boring and I was, okay, I'm becoming a nerd. So I said, okay, like, maybe it can be funnier if I just put a mic and do the same thing, but for real.
Yep.
So then I start to reuse acoustic instrument. I used to play accordion, which was for me a joke because I thought it was really old-fashioned, ridiculous instruments.
Yeah, and we're going to play one of the tracks, actually, in just a moment on the programme from USA, which is Pern. Before we play that, maybe can you tell us a little bit about that track as well? What are some of the sounds that we'll be able to hear? Maybe which part of the island, what part of your experience there informed the beginnings of that track in particular?
Pern is the northwest edge of the island. It's kind of the most dramatic coast of the island, so it was the bit obvious place to start the recording. So I start with that, and it all grew from there. Choice.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll take a listen to that in just a moment. But Jan, it's been wonderful to speak to you. Thanks so much for coming to tell us all about
Thank
the new
you.
Record. Andrew, well, let's waste no more time and listen to the track Jan was talking about. This is from USA, and it's called Pern. Beautiful stuff. The sounds of Jan Tiersen, and that was Pern from the new album USA, which is out now. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Henry Hitchens last visited the Monocle Weekly back in 2013 when he taught us a much-needed lesson in how to be polite, as outlined in his book Sorry, the English and Their Manners.
He's back this week with a new book that celebrates another genteel activity we'd all do well to indulge in rather more often, a meander through the world's best bookstores. Browse the World in Bookshops asks 15 writers from around the globe, including Ali Smith, Elif Shafak and Ian Sinclair, to reflect on the bookshops that have most influenced them. Henry joined me earlier to tell me all about it. Henry Hitchings, welcome back to Midori House. Very good to have you with us again. And we've spoken about, well, I think we sort of talked about manners and this sort of thing, but people may be familiar with some of your work before about, well, language, letters, books. So it's perhaps no surprise, or we should not be surprised, that you've turned your sights or trained them on The World in Bookshops, the subtitle of Browse, which is the new book. It's an obvious question, I suppose, given the setup, but why look to bookshops and what they mean to writers?
I would love us if there were some incredibly sexy story to tell about it. The truth is, I've just been a huge lover of bookshops for a really long time. And one senses that bookshops are in jeopardy at the moment, certainly independent bookshops. And I think they're wonderful resources, you know, not just as shops, but as mustering points for ideas and for people who love words and ideas and discussion and debate, and also people who love peace and quiet. I talk in the book about how bookshops are the only kind of grotto that is also a lighthouse. They're havens, but they're also places of enlightenment. And I think the bookshop is something to be cherished, its virtues are to be extolled, and it seems to me that it's under some threat. And the book is a kind of polemic, but I thought rather than just me ventilating on the subject, I'd get a load of, frankly, better known and more talented people to do it, you know, with me.
So modest. But it is interesting, Henry, you know, a real parade of talents. We'll maybe talk about a couple of the specific tales and stories and how they speak to some of these other things in a second. But I guess on that broader point then, when you approached, I don't know, what was it, some of your favourite writers, friends, acquaintances, what was the process like when you began to draw these things together?
Well, the process is a bit haphazard. I mean, the first thing that happens when you start approaching people, and I did start by approaching authors I particularly admire and authors who I thought would write very interestingly about the subject and also people I thought realistically might want to contribute. And when I was approaching all these people, the first question they ask is, who else is involved? And of course, at the outset, the answer is, well, apart from me, nobody. What then happens is, as you get other people involved, so the project gains a kind of momentum and other people think, oh, well, actually, I'd quite like to be in hardcovers alongside Ali Smith or Elif Shafak or someone like that. And in the end, I think we could probably have commissioned quite a few more essays. I should say one of the things that was absolutely essential to me was that all these pieces should be new pieces that hadn't appeared. You know, it's not an anthology of writing from the past. It's not sort of recycled journalism. It's all fresh, and that it should be personal and that it should be international as well.
Henry, let me ask you then about some of the strands that run through that fresh and those personal stories. Were there certain kind of truths? And you began by talking about what bookshops mean, and these extraordinary beacons, such important places, but there's so much more to it. There's mystery, there's intrigue. Were there certain kind of truths that seemed to be international? Were there things that wherever you went and whatever the approach of the writers that we have in the book, were there things that ran through?
There are. I mean, I think they're not particularly surprising. One is the bookshop as a kind of bastion of intellectualism and artistry and creativity, somewhere that you see that arrayed around you. It's not that it's happening right in front of you, but it's exhibited. You know, bookshops are temples of literariness, and that's something that I think is universal. Also, the sense that bookshops can be agents or instruments of political activity was something that was quite important. I mean, it's something that Ala Alaswani talks about in his writing about a bookshop in Cairo and the revolution in Egypt, but it's actually something that a lot of other people touched on. And I think one of the key strands, which is universal, is the idea that one of the pleasures of bookshops is going away with something you weren't expecting to go away with. You go there, and it's not like going to the supermarket saying, right, well, I want a pint of milk and some lentils. You go in thinking you want one thing, and you come out with two completely different things.
And Henry, it is interesting. You talked at the beginning about bookshops being under threat, and whether it's a perception or indeed a reality, sadly, around the world. For one reason or another, it might be because there are restrictions on freedom of speech or expression. It may also just be, you know, the commercial realities, and there are pressures on print, which, you know, we rail against here at Monocle as loudly as anyone. How many of the tales did touch upon that idea of the bookshop as something, if not long gone, that was under threat? So almost something that's lost. Was there a lot of, I don't know, melancholy takes or wistful looks back?
I think melancholy and nostalgia come into it, and quite a few of the essays, probably about a third, are about places that don't exist anymore that were crucial to the development of a writer. Yi-Yun Lee's essay, for example, is very much about that, the English language bookshop that she went to in China, which is long gone. Ian Sinclair has a nice piece about a bookshop in St. Leonard's, which used to be somewhere he'd go and ransack. And the thing that inspired his essay was discovering that it was closing down. There is that sense of bookshops' precariousness and of the need to cherish that. But some of the essays are not nostalgic and are actually very contemporary and are not sort of wistful for what's gone, but are much more about how bookshops now can be more dynamic and be more exciting. Because I think the reality is we all have experiences of bookshops that are very, very good, but we also have experiences of bookshops that aren't. I think a lot of booksellers have got a lot more agile and a lot more evangelical about what they're doing, but we all sometimes have that experience of going to a bookshop and thinking, no, this is not how you do it, and being, you know, quite angry because there's a limited space for bookshops. And
well, I wanted to ask you about exactly that point. Would it be a mistake if, I don't know, the next sort of independent bookshop entrepreneur were to sort of read this book as something of a primer? Do you think they would find helpful direction as to what a bookshop really needs or what a bookshop maybe really means?
I think the answer
of course
to that
they
question
would.
Is yes. I think the only thing I would add is that I definitely wasn't setting out to create a kind of primer. It's not really like that. But yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it, actually. Lots lots of different perspectives. And as I was saying, one of the things which is important to me is internationalism. So we've got writers from places like Ukraine and Colombia and Kenya and Turkey and Denmark. You know, not just having British or an American, a very Anglophone approach to everything. I really wanted it not to feel like my Britishness dominated. When I go abroad, I love going to bookshops, and you know, of course, there are always things they have in common with the ones I'm used to, but also there can be some bookshops are extraordinarily odd in ways that are kind of brilliant. Sometimes that's an architectural thing, but sometimes it's more a cultural thing and how they sit in their community and stuff like that. And I definitely wanted to have people in the book who weren't just coming at it the way I was.
Though, always nice for it to have a little echo of friendly parochialism. I think, is it in Ian Sanson's book, he writes about foils not too far from here on the Charing Cross Road. So in a way, it's nice sometimes to have those local stories. Certainly anyone from London will know that's a proper institution that everyone's familiar with.
I think you want an element of that, but it actually, this, I suppose the thing I'm most proud of about the book is the fact that it has a real range of voices in terms of where people are from. And the only irony is there are two people from Germany, which is a sort of strange thing that just turned out. But they're actually two of the most idiosyncratic pieces in the entire collection by Daniel Kehlmann and Sasa Stanisic. Those pieces kind of talk to each other as well in a kind of curious way.
Well, speaking of curiosity, do you think that there are places that, you know, having researched, compiled and edited the book, that you think I need to go and explore more deeply, whether it's Maybe it is bookshops in Germany, or is it further afield? Do you get a sense of pages as yet unturned in your own experience of bookshops from working on this project?
100%, and I think perhaps I see bookshops a little differently. But yes, interestingly, this is sort of parochial, but one place I really want to go back to, because I haven't been there for 15 years or something like that, is Hay-on-Wye, where it's interesting because I refer to it in my introduction. And the figure that I had in my mind was that there are 40 bookshops in Hay-on-Wye, but I think there are now 24, which tells you rather melancholy story about what's happening. It's amazing that there are 24 bookshops in somewhere with a population of 1,500, but at the same time, that is an index of this kind of decline of independent secondhand bookselling. And you were talking about reality biting. The internet has been the single biggest driver of change here. Obviously, internet-based operations, including Amazon, you know, the elephant in the room, can have incredible inventory and can have incredible prices. And if their customer service is good, it can be very hard for people to resist their allure. And I think bookshops have to be smart about how they maintain particularly high standards of service and make the customer experience a lot more engaging and a lot stickier, basically. Though we don't want sticky books, I should say.
That's not good from a pragmatic point of view. That's interesting, though, Henry, that you made that point. Where do you stand on that, then? It seems to me you've got a fairly, I don't know, pragmatic, then, view on the digital future. You talk about extraordinary inventory, good pricing. You know, these are good things for the market. And I guess there's a story about people who maybe wouldn't have access to huge realms of literature, and suddenly that access is there, even if it's brought in by a drone. Should we be relaxed about a twin future where we have great bookshops, but we also have these digital titans? Or is it important to be wary and make sure that we don't let things get kind of out of control?
I think that ship has sailed. I mean, if we're lucky, it will be a twin future. And that's what I foresee. But there's a degree of wishfulness about that. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I buy books from online operations, particularly secondhand books that can be very hard to track down, and you find that someone in Tennessee has got a copy of it in good condition. I do that, but that doesn't stop me going to bricks and mortar bookshops. And I think the two experiences are different. And in an ideal life, if you have the time and the resources, you go to both. But the key thing for me about bricks and mortar bookshops is that opportunity to browse, to discover things you didn't know existed, the serendipity of it. And that is why I think that the bookshops will endure. But I think something that maybe needs to be explored is the relationship between publishers and bookshops. It seems to me that publishers have a very powerful interest in bookshops continuing to exist. And I don't think they always recognize that in their dealings with them. You know, there may be a case for actually publishers doing more to quite literally prop up. Well, maybe not quite literally prop up, but more literally than maybe some people would think. But, you know, booksellers, I think that it's very, very important.
I mean, could that be a model? It's interesting. I wonder if I'm sat here in, I don't know, 25 years and there's Browse Volume 2, and it's 15 contemporary writers of that age writing about their experience. Do you think that some of these narratives will be the same? Would we be reassured by the journeys of discovery, the serendipity you've described? Or do you think there still needs to be another change, whether it's publishers getting involved in bricks and mortar or something like that? Where do you think we'll be in, I don't know, 20 odd years' time?
I mean, I don't like making predictions. I think one thing that's really important to me, which is slightly sort of askance from what you're saying, is that books, in order to survive, need to be physically desirable, aesthetically desirable objects in order to make a case for why you should buy a physical book rather than an e-book or just, you know, read something on a screen. And I think that's something that some publishers have embraced, and I think it's something that booksellers really enjoy. You notice that sometimes there are new entrants to the publishing market who get quite a lot of exposure quite quickly, and it's because booksellers love the actual artifacts that they're producing, and it's then great you can display them, because obviously you want your bookshop to look gorgeous, and one of the easiest ways to do that is to make it full of gorgeous books. But some publishers, you know, rather dismayingly, seem to be stamping on production costs and actually producing kind of cheaper, crummier books. I think that if the physical book is to survive, it has to become more desirable as an object, and I think that the future of bookselling generally is really bound up with that.
Nice pun, bound up. And a perfect prompt to say one such covetable edition is this. Browse the World in Bookshops, published by Pushkin Press, edited by Henry Hitchings. Henry, thanks very much for coming to talk to us all about it.
Thank you very much indeed.
That was Tom speaking to Henry Hitchings. And you're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
Judy Calla is a London-based chef whose passion for food from her family's home, Palestine, led her to set up a restaurant and deli, Beatty Kitchen, in the city.
And her latest project is Palestine on a Plate, a new book celebrating the recipes of Palestine and an accompanying app of the same name. And she joins us now to tell us more about the region's best eats. Judy, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to have you with us. Before we talk about the book, maybe we can talk a bit about your own food journey, because often when you talk to foodie folk from wherever they hail, their food journey begins with family, it's early memories, it's, you know, grandma's recipes, mum's recipes. Is your food experience rooted in the same kind of beginnings?
Totally. Everything about this book is all about memories and feelings. And when I was young, I would just sort of hang around my mum and her nine sisters, and my dad had seven sisters. They would all come and go as, you know, time went, and I found that was the most fun for me. I used to have friends over, but I'd end up leaving them alone and end up with my mum baking something, and she'd have things ready for me to make a cake or something, not to kind of get into the real food.
And so, and some big cakes, I'm guessing, if you've got, how many aunts is that? Like 16
or
something?
Loads,
that's a lot of people.
Loads, and everyone has five kids and most of them are girls, so we had lots of cousins and we would just hang out a lot together. And the food really reminds me of a lot of moments in my childhood, and they were good. So I thought the best way is to document everything. It wasn't originally documented for an app or a book or anything. It was really more for me to just have everything there when I needed it.
Now, we're going to ask you about Palestinian food in a moment, but when you eat in the region, when you go to Lebanon or if you've been to Syria or any of those places, that food is a very social thing. Mm. You've nicely done these recipes for serving 4 to 6, but people are literally serving often a huge number of people. Is the heart of much of the recipes here, is it's something social, it's about sharing, it's about community?
Totally. I mean, all the recipes are very easily adaptable to make them for 10, 20, 30 people, because that's how they originated in my restaurant. So I had to sort of do them the opposite way rather than build them, you know, to 4 and 6. I had to kind of bring them down from bulk recipes, which is how we did them at home. they were never really for 4 to 6. We never had one pepper. We had 7 peppers and 7 aubergines and 10 tomatoes stuffed with something. So it was easy to sort of bring it back down. And everything is shared with something else. So you don't have one dish and that's your dinner. It's that with a salad on the side or a soup to start. And every, you know, recipe has a recommendation to have something else with it. So it is definitely a feast.
You know, as we were saying, here in London, you can have, you know, just around the corner here, you can go and eat Persian, you can go eat Lebanese. But what are the things which set Palestinian cooking apart? Is it the ingredients? Is it the spicing? What would make you say, okay, this is Palestinian?
There are some dishes in the book that have been appearing in restaurants that are very, very traditionally Palestinian. For instance, there's a dish called masakhan, which is a chicken and onion and sumac with loads of olive oil served on this bread that they cook on hot stones. And this is known in all of the Middle East as Palestinian. And matloube, which is made in Lebanon and Syria and Iraq and wherever. It's either with chicken and cauliflower or lamb and aubergines that are fried and kind of laid in a cake, cooked without being moved around and tipped up like a cake, which is also very traditional. And then the rest of the food is Palestinian only because my grandmother cooked it and she only knew Palestine. But because of where we are located in the world, we have an amazing trade route. So we have influences from everywhere, from China to Asia to France and Germany and Cyprus, so, and Lebanon and Syria and the close neighbours. So it's very much influenced by everything, but it's, again, Palestinian because of my grannies.
But that is interesting, and you talk about that sort of the outward-looking nature of Palestinian cuisine. And do you think that's something that personally has been important? I mean, you were born in Qatar, is that right?
Yeah.
You raised in London, so you're quite an international character. As you build your own sense of great food, do you continue to look globally? You know, as you travel, do you bring things in, or is it a question more of always returning to those kind of fundamentals?
I'm always returning. I use lots of different things. I like to eat different foods. I don't eat Palestinian food every day. I try to as much as I can because I love it, but I do try to bring other foods that I've eaten and make them more our way of cooking, just by default, because it's the flavour that I like the most and enjoy eating. But I think, yeah, like I said, we've been influenced by so many different countries, and I think we can influence as well, which is a great thing.
And tell me, it's interesting when we've talked to people about food before on the show, and people are part of a community that lives in a large part as a diaspora, when people are spread around the world. Food takes on an even greater significance. It is those common moments when you're in a different country where you come together and there is an immediate recognition of, you know, of other people like yourselves. Do you still find that here living in London, or when you're in Qatar where you would meet Palestinian people and suddenly you could tap into your heritage in a richer way than if you were just eating Palestinian food or Lebanese food with just general Londoner friends?
Yeah, I think our food sort of brings us together. It's like an identity for us, and we're sort of holding on to it because it's sort of the last thing left for us, obviously because of history and what's happening to our land. So it is something that brings us together and bonds really before even knowing somebody. I meet a lot of online and on Instagram and Facebook, and they're always messaging me things. And just the nicest, kindest people who are so passionate and write me stories about me and my book or whatever it is that has made them think about something, and thanking me for something that is out there. It's just not so out there. But it is just to create this unity with people. And I think food is the best way to sort of break barriers with anybody.
I mean, that's definitely true. And you have all these, you know, metaphors like breaking bread with people. You know, it's very immediate. But is it sometimes difficult to keep politics out of the kitchen almost? Because if you're viewed as someone who's a representative then of what Palestinian food is, you're also, I guess, a representative of what Palestine is or could be or should be. Is that ever a pressure? Do you find that difficult? Do people try and politicize
all the
food?
Time. Yeah, I think in this particular case, it is, because it's been something that's been going on for nearly 70 years. And really, even having the title Palestine on the front of the book was something quite controversial. I found it a little bit difficult with other publishers who were just not interested at all in the book if that was the title. And it's
so
not...
So literally in a word, if you say Palestine on a plate, that's some publishers are just...
Well, not some. Like 23 publishers said no and that they would be interested if I changed the title because it was too political. And the book is not political. It is because of the title, but if you read it...
There's nothing
political about it. It's just what history says. When my grandmothers were there, they lived there, they grew up there, their grandparents and parents and so on. It depends who's looking and who's asking, but I don't think in this instance politics can be removed from it because everyone's so heightened about the subject. But if you look closer, you'll find great recipes and enjoy yourself while you're cooking them. So.
Well, and I think also the thing I love about Middle Eastern food, I'm somebody who doesn't eat meat by fish and things. And the amazing thing about if you go to any kind of Middle Eastern restaurant, you can just start with the meze or the smaller dishes. And there are so many kind of rich vegetarian dishes in here and amazing fish dishes. Is that always part of the regional way of eating? That, you know, there is... so many options of, you know, just eating healthily, eating these great, great salads and amazing pieces of fish.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I was writing the book, I was splitting things into chapters and it turned out to be basically a vegetarian book by accident. And I didn't even realize it. And then they were telling me, you know, you need more meat. We have lots of meat and fish dishes. It's just we have way more vegetarian options. So I had to take out a lot and then add some more and, you know, they had to sort of balance out. But I would never have thought that we're more a vegetarian family because we eat so well. No one's ever complaining that something's missing because, you know, some people think they haven't eaten well if they haven't had meat or fish or some kind of chicken. We never grew up with labels. We were just eating. So yeah, it's a very healthy way of eating. I think there are only a few recipes that you can fry something, but then you can obviously bake them instead if they are, you know, not healthy. But generally, the book is very varied with a lot of good ingredients that you can find everywhere. I mean, we're not living in the tropics where there's, you know, ingredients you can't find. And now we're lucky that because of other chefs have brought Middle Eastern food really to the forefront, that you can find pretty much everything in most of your local shops.
And beautifully shot, I think. Yeah. There's a real kind of... it's very hard to bring food to life, the regional food, without going in for the cliches, but there is a hint of blue tile or a nice piece of fabric always in the background that kind of roots you in place. For you, seeing, you know, food that you know how to make and you know how you serve it, but seeing someone interpret that as a food stylist, is that an interesting relationship?
To be honest with you, I was very much involved with the food styling and choosing everything. I was very lucky because it's my first book. Nobody really knows who I am. And, you know, sometimes you kind of get left aside. But it was really a team effort because I wanted it to look like how I would present it at home or in a restaurant. And it's not just sort of dumped on the table and just everyone goes for it. We do still take a lot of pride in our food at home and serve it nicely in a nice platter and everyone has a spoon and so on. So the tiles that we use and all the platters, they're all mine. Majority of them are mine. I get them from places where I use them for my events and supper clubs. So I serve these types of dishes for people when they come to eat.
And you've also brought in some food. Now, is this food that you're bringing into the country or is this Palestinian food that you've sourced here in London?
Well, the ingredients are majority are from, you know, obviously a fishmonger and a butcher and so on. But the tahini and the za'atar and suma are all really from this lovely company that I met when I had my restaurant. And they approached me to stock their products, which is this Zaytoun brand. And they are fantastic. And it's not because of anything else, I chose to use them. I had different brands that I was using, but because they are organic and fair trade and Palestinian.
Andrew's talking in
the
mic.
They appeal to me a lot, and obviously it creates work for people in Palestine, and their products are good. Really, really good. And
Tom, I've been meaning to ask you for years. You'd like a date?
we were saying before, it's something...
They're sticky, so you might find it hard to speak after.
I'll give it a go. You look too good.
We can make this work.
It's date night here. go for it, Tom. Nice. I love dates.
Yeah. I love a good date, Andrew.
Everybody does.
And za'atar, this is you have this with like olive oil and bread.
You can have it with everything. Literally, I have it in some breakfast recipes, and I also put it on fish, a bit on meat and salads. It's one of the, it's almost like salt. You can put it on everything. But I would always recommend to buy a good version of it, because when you buy not so great ones, they taste very woody and they ruin dishes. So I'd spend a little bit more.
A bit more like sawdust if you're not careful.
So tread carefully.
It is, yeah.
Judy, what about if we look at, I mean, this is probably a question which you hate, and I know it annoys chefs and cooks when I ask them questions like this, but is there a singular ingredient? Is there one taste, one flavour, or something that really captures the essence, you know, that is Palestine on a plate, if you like? Is it about that one date that's just perfect from just the right place that takes you somewhere?
It's very hard.
No, but you know what I mean? Is there one thing? I mean, when you think, if someone said to you, you know, can you boil it down? Or is it more about that thing, those experiences that we talked about?
It's a combination of things. It's really hard. I was just thinking, yeah, za'atar would be the one, but then without olive oil, it wouldn't work. And then dates, great, but then you'd have to have some coffee with it on the side. There's no, I think it's impossible to just take one thing. I think tahine and za'atar are probably the most used and very good for you. But yeah, impossible to answer.
Don't make you choose.
I can't.
Well, Judy Keller, thank you so much for coming in to see
us. Thank you.
We always like somebody who brings food.
Exactly, it gets off to a flying start.
But we've particularly enjoyed meeting you. The book is called Palestine on a Plate, Memories from My Mother's Kitchen. And just tell us before we say goodbye, if people can go online. Do you have a website that people can find out more about you?
I've literally put every link you can find to get the book, because it's selling in the States and Canada and, you know, internationally. So if you go to palestineonaplate.com, every country can buy their version of the book, because it's been obviously edited and changed for different
kitchens. we heartily recommend it. Thank you so much for coming to see us.
Thanks for having me.
So there we have it, Andrew. Edition 378 of the Monocle Weekly. And I can see you're still clutching a small container of dates to your bosom.
I'm still hopeful that I may be able to secure some more people who would like to have a date with me later on when I leave the studio.
Oh, it's such a sad voice. What a great show, though. I mean, we crested such heights, so the sublime, the ridiculous. We went on a beautiful musical journey through the sort of where the Atlantic and the English Channel meet. We went on a foodie journey through the Middle East. And then we went on the whatever the journey was that Henry Rhys Sheridan led us on.
And you met Mr. Hitchens on your own. I'm sorry about that.
No, but what an absolute gent. And a beautiful book, actually. Some amazing tales of books. Do you have a favourite? If someone said, Andrew Tuck, you need to write a few thousand words on a favourite bookstore, could you choose? It doesn't even have to still be around anymore.
No, I'll tell you, the two that I find myself going to, the one in London, obviously around the corner from us, Daunt Books, I like going there because everyone's super friendly and they've got to know us and they don't kind of try and sell you, you know, three books for the price of two, whatever. And luckily, when we go to work in the office in New York, not far from the office in New York, is a very nice bookshop called McNally Jackson, which oddly there's going to be a tiny piece about in the next issue because it has an intriguing Canada link, which will explain all. And I love that place because you go in and they'll be having a reading, or there's a kids' playgroup going on the corner, there's poets, there's really a good edit of books, and they also do some nice birthday cards.
There you go. It's a win-win situation. What a show it was. Should we dish out some thanks to the makers, the behind-the-scenes movers and shakers?
Let's do it. The show was produced by Tom Hall, who's already snuck in and had a date with me. It was researched by Beatrice Carmi, who's very young. I'm not going to make any comment. And our studio manager was Claire Urban. And I know she's desperate to come in and have a date as well. So the Monocle Weekly is going to be back at the same time next week. For now, from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
It's cheerio and goodbye.